Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. Well, if you want to know where you're headed, you have to know where you are, and that means you have to know where you've been. Continuing with our annual tradition, we've got the best year-end review in the business, thanks to today's guest, Dave Collum. For those of you unfamiliar with Dave, maybe haven't listened to last year's podcast or read last year's year in review, he is professor of chemistry and chemical biology at Cornell University, where I got my MBA. We didn't meet there. Wish we had. In addition to his academic interests, Dave authors this annual macroeconomic assessment titled The Year in Review. It's hands down, as I mentioned, the best synopsis of anything that mattered in the previous 12 months. And boy, there's a lot of stuff to cover. His latest year in review can once again be found on Peak Prosperity, and I'm excited to have him with us now live in order to expand on his excellent insights. There's so much to cover. Dave, thanks for joining us again this year.
Hey, this is a blast. I love it. And it's just, I would do it just to sit around and chat with you for an hour or so.
Well, I would do it just for that reason to talk with you because, you've really just been capturing everything that's been going on, and boy, so much. So I don't even know where to dive in. Let's start here. If you had to pick one, what's the biggest theme for you this year that really stands out in the economy? Let's start with the economy.
You know, interestingly, the economy is kind of holding up. It was like it was on life support or something all year. And so in some sense, this year didn't feel like the economy as much as other years. But with that said, in a late season spectacular moment, we got into it with the Russians. And next thing you know, the price of oil is plummeting. And no one seems to know what to make of it. But I think that'll probably turn out to be an important event. And I think it'll be important economically. I think it'll also be important geopolitically as well as militarily, maybe. I mean, this is a big event.
I agree. You know, I'm having trouble really saying that there's much standing out economically particularly, but what I do see is this global theme that, if I can put it this way, I wasn't alive then, but it feels like 1911, right? So people say, hey, we don't really know what happened. An archduke got shot. We're going to call it World War One. That's why it happened. That was the reason. But in truth, you know, there were these pressures that had built up. So to me, the big themes this year is this breakdown of relations with Russia that I still don't understand. I don't understand why it happened or what the end game is. There must be something else happening. But it feels to me like this whole plummet, crash in oil prices has to be connected to that in some way, directly, but certainly it's indirectly connected because it's abusing all the oil exporters badly, and Russia being a prime example. So as you look at that oil, let's turn there, because to me that is probably going to turn out to be the macroeconomic event of the year, even though it's happening here in November and December. What do you see as behind the oil price collapse?
Well, you know, actually, just to back out a second, since I thought you wanted to keep me on the economy, let me just pan out a little bit and say that to me, the global economic theme is existential risk. And that's a phrase I use repeatedly throughout my year in review. And that is there's just things that now seem to be coming to a head. And a metaphor that I came up with that that I just love because I know the game well, is this game of Tetris, this global Tetris. And I when you play that thing, you know, you place these pieces methodically, and then the game starts accelerating, and you start placing pieces faster and faster. And you reach some point where you simply can no longer successfully place the pieces. And it feels like the authorities, the monetary authorities, the geopolitical authorities, you know, all those people who are really calling shots around the globe are playing that game, and it feels like it's accelerating now. And the end of the game is called topping out, and I'm wondering when that topping out is going to occur. With that said, the energy is part of that game. That's one of the many facets of this year that just felt like something big could happen. And so you listen to the pundits on TV, and they get the fact that it's about Russia. There's a lot of discussion about how the Saudis are trying to put our frackers out of business. I don't think that's it. I think it actually started with ISIS threatening Saudi Arabia and us meanwhile being in a tiff with Russia, which in my opinion is our fault. So I agree with you. I don't know what happened. This geopolitical situation, I can't even tell you a story about what happened, but it appears so it started when we toppled the democratically elected government in Russia. And then from there, the Russians moved to Crimea. Next thing you know, we don't like that. So then the Saudis end up threatened by ISIS. And I think what we said to them, this is speculation. I think what we said to them was, look, here's what we'll do. You talk down the price of oil, that'll beat up Putin. We'll take care of ISIS. We'll call that even, right? And so the first thing that appeared in the oil sector, in my opinion, the first thing that I spotted were the Saudis talking about where they would be comfortable with oil. Mm-hmm. It's contemporaneous with us starting to sort of saber rattle against Russia. And the Saudis are not comfortable with lower oil prices. They say that for a reason. And the reason seemed patently obvious tied to the Crimea problem. And so, maybe our frackers are knocked out, but the price of oil was doing great. They were selling oil at a high price. So I don't see how that makes sense.
Well, it doesn't make sense. And here's the other thing, to say that Saudi Arabia is interested in putting the frackers out of business. Saudi Arabia produces mostly heavy grades and sour grades of crude. So people often get confused because it's presented in the media as if there's like an oil market, right? Oh, there's just oil. It's this one substance. It's like saying water, fresh water. It's this one thing. It's not. There are all these different grades. And the truth is that the kind of grades that come out of the fracked area are really light, sweet grades. And they're not in competition with Saudi Arabia at all. Like you to have a refinery, you have to build it, and you have to build it for a very narrow range of crude grades that can be put through that thing. And so our refineries in this country are mostly geared for heavy and sour grades at this point in time. So we're still importing oil, and we're still running it through our refiners, and we've got all this stuff piling up. So when they say in the United States, oh, we're interested in exporting oil again, what we're really saying is we're interested in exporting these grades of oil that we don't even have any use for because we got so much of this stuff here, because the grades are all wrong. So Saudi Arabia is not in direct competition with the frackers because they don't produce the same product. And that's an important point that really isn't being talked about much yet.
Yeah, boy, you're much better at that stuff than me. I think that's right. And I don't think that the frackers ever were in any way threatening Saudi Arabia, as you say. Interesting, at some point in the next few minutes, we should talk about whether they understood the collateral damage that would be done as we attempted to engineer a serious beating on Putin. Did we understand all the collateral damage that would be done? It's not obvious to me that we understood that.
No, this is a great point. And I believe, this is my personal view, that the people in the State Department are political beasts and the people in the executive branch are political animals. And that's what they know. And so geopolitically, it probably makes a lot of sense to go ahead and crush oil and see if you can really batter Putin a little further. Because, the sanctions on his friends and advisors wasn't really cutting it for some reason. So when we look at that, though, then you have to turn the page and look at the other part of the story. Already, we have $150 billion of worldwide projects, oil projects that have been yanked. Tar sands, deep water, now shale projects are being yanked. So we're looking at that and the thing those political animals and beasts don't understand is, A, you need oil to run an economy, and B, the world has spent since 2005 $3.8 trillion and gotten exactly zero more barrels out of the ground for their trouble. So we're on this treadmill in this story right now where we have to spend huge amounts of capital just to keep our oil quantities in place, and that is all now at risk. And I don't think the political animals really get that. And I certainly hope people in the oil business are knocking on their door going, hey, you have to understand something here. This industry can't take a year of these prices.
And what do you bet they didn't see the crisis in the high-yield debt market coming, right? I think when they crushed Putin, when they went to crush Putin, which by the way, and I talk a lot about Putin in this year in review, but the idea of trying to hurt the Russians, I mean, cause pain, these guys are tougher than nails, right? These guys survived the siege of Leningrad. You're not going to hurt them in a way that would hurt us if it was a quid pro quo. But do you think the guys in the State Department understood what would happen to our junk bond market when we crush Putin? I'd be shocked if they saw that.
I don't think they think in economic terms or energy terms or environmental terms. I don't think any of that stuff really fits on their radar screens. I believe that they are just purely political animals. And I see that written out again and again and again. Everything the Justice Department has and has not done, everything that the State Department has and has not done, everything that Obama proposes and fails to propose, none of those make sense to me on economic terms, energy terms, environment terms, none of that. They're all just political maneuvers. But that's how I see it.
I think that's correct. And I also think one of the things we witnessed this year was that Obama, I gave Obama a pass for a few years. I'm not a liberal Democrat, but I was not a Bush fan either. And so I gave him a pass. I thought, okay, so liberals do have ideas that trump conservative ideas in some areas. And so I was open to the idea, but I think Obama's a bit of a sociopath. And I've really turned on him pretty hard at this point. And I don't think he's up to the task of going against Putin. And so, meanwhile, Obama's throwing his rhetoric that he thinks is so clever at Putin. And Putin's this incredibly tough ex-KGB guy. He's not gonna care about that. He doesn't care what people think. And by the way, his popularity rankings in Russia are probably 5 multiples of Obama's here, right? I mean, he's a popular guy in Russia. You're not going to pressure him. They'll eat less food. They'll heat their houses less. They'll take the beatings.
Absolutely. So I do think that I share with you this idea that Russia is a tough adversary. It's not as simple as, calling in some NATO airstrikes and getting rid of Gaddafi and, feeling flush from that and, running a little revolution in Egypt and getting somebody tossed out there and then, doing a little crush action on Syria and whatever we've done in Iraq. I think the State Department had sort of gotten ahead of itself in believing that it really could go undertake regime change wherever it wanted to. And I think that's what they're after in Russia. And Putin has said as much, right? He said they're going for regime change here too. Good luck with that, right? It's not going to happen.
What do they think they're going to get when Putin's done? That's what I don't understand. So this whole battle with Russia looks to me like we just didn't get. Why do I think I know? I don't know. There was a guy named Mearsheimer, I think, who wrote an article that was just truly brilliant. It was brought to my attention by Ben Steele at the CFR. And a basic what Mearsheimer said was we wanted Ukraine to be more friendly to our needs, right? And I think at times our needs are kind of whimsical needs. This is not some sort of national security need. This is just what we want. And what we failed to calculate is Russia had to have Ukraine for its needs. And so ours were wishes, his were needs. You don't win that one, right? This is a losing fight. And so we'd knock over regime. We create a vacuum. Russians come running in, unmarked vehicles. And I think we must have known that would happen. But I don't know what our end game was. It really seemed like a foolish thing. And I'm not going to criticize Putin for this. I get Putin's response. He's a mean guy. I don't doubt that. But we elicited his response this time. In my opinion, I think history is going to be pretty punishing to these guys, to our team on this one.
Well, I knew it was bad when both Gorbachev and Kissinger, within 2 days of each other, came out of their caves. Kissinger at least lives in a cave, I think, and said, "Hey, let me give you a little diplomatic tip here." Kissinger basically said, "If you don't have the end in sight, you really shouldn't be doing what you're doing." Like, he basically said exactly what you said, which is, "I don't think you guys know what you're doing here," and because nobody can detect what the end game is. So, massive uncertainty. Nobody seems to really know what the game is. That's why I think it's like 1911. Nobody can explain. And I've talked to people who are, very intelligent, people who've been in the business, people who've been in government. And I've been asking the same question, which is, what is our game plan with Russia? And nobody can say. Like, even when we say, we've put all these sanctions on Russia so that they will, so that they will do something different. And I've asked, nobody can tell me what the list is. What should they do different? Exactly what would they do differently? And it was hysterical when there was that G20 meeting down in Brisbane, and Harper comes up from Canada and says to Putin, "Hey, you really need to get your troops out of Ukraine." And Putin's like, "I don't have any troops in Ukraine." And in this day and age with satellites, that if you can't show a picture and say, "There are your troops, see them? See all those troops?" Like, yeah. Nobody can produce the pictures so that they're still at the level of the Prime Minister of Canada is going fact-free in a confrontational way with another superpower without any data is astonishing to me. And so that to me is sort of just a larger metaphor for what I'm seeing in the markets as well. There's a lot of fact-free sort of positioning and maneuvering going on. And I've been extraordinarily bearish on these markets for a while, not because I think they're necessarily going to go down, although I think they ought to in a lot of cases, but because they no longer represent reality to me in any way, shape, or form.
So the other answer to your original question is what did I pay attention to? I think I spent the majority of ATP in my brain worrying about the bond market this year.
Yeah.
And we are hitting multi-century lows in yields, which, as your readers already know, it means that the prices of the bonds are at multi-century highs. And I actually put a list of yields by country in my review, and they're ridiculous. And so you're looking at these long duration bonds that are returning nothing. And so you've got currency risk, you've got default risk. I mean, we're talking Spain at 3%. This is just crazy time.
On the 10-year, right? And yeah. Italy at 2% on the 10-year.
Oh, God, those are not investors. Those are either speculators or just pure sovereign interventions, and probably a combination. But the bond market I watched all year, in the best case scenario, this is the horrifying part. The best case scenario is the market never collapses and you don't get squat for yield forever. How is that possibly good? And then for the bond owners, it's much worse from there, right? The bond owners could lose all their principal, and they could really get crushed, and it's not a retrievable crushing. If they get crushed, that principal's gone. For the bond buyers, that would be the best case scenario. You and I probably, we would love to see interest rates soar at some point, and then we could scoop up the debris. But they're just going to resist that at all costs. And so we've pulled all our returns coming forward. And so there's no return left. By the way, since equities are priced to the sky, according to the Case-Shiller index, and bonds are priced to the out of the solar system, if we do have a bad event where things start dropping, they're going to go simultaneously, unlike 2009 where where bonds covered for stocks. You're going to have a simultaneous paroxysm, to use a Stockman term, and it's just going to be so bad.
A theme we use at Peak Prosperity is this idea of out from the outside in, meaning that when markets start to go, they go at the periphery first. So in the bond market, the periphery are these junk bonds, which I couldn't believe they traded for over a year with either a 4 handle or a 5 handle, right? 4 to 5% for junk bonds, right? And so as you mentioned before, this junk bond market is now having a little bit of a come to Jesus moment, right? It's like, uh-oh, risk actually exists. And I will tell you that the 17% of junk bonds, which is a very large number, it's over $100 billion, that are associated with the shale drillers is very much exposed to pure default risk at this point in time. And very, very rapidly, unless they get access to being able to roll those junk bonds back over again, every time those bonds come due, you're going to see a default going forward unless oil prices rapidly tick up. But nobody had a sense of risk anymore. There was no risk. It was like it had been completely taken away. Central banks, through coordinated printing, have apparently completely eliminated risk. That has to be a macro theme for 2014 that I think we'll look back on and go, wow, what were we thinking?
Yeah, and you know, for several years now, the term risk has been used synonymously with return. And that just is surreal to me. So the phrase that I use, been using off and on through quite a while now, is that I think people seeking risk are eventually going to find it. And when put in that way, you go, oh my God, I hadn't thought of it quite like that. So when they talk about people going out on the risk curve, excuse me, that's like walking the gangplank, right? And so they will find risk. And then they're going to discover that it's called risk for a perfectly good reason. And the bond guys are going to discover that it was a bond and it was so big that they couldn't see it. I call it a caldera. I actually Googled that, and best I can tell, I own that term. I'm not sure it's that clever, but I was pleased because it's so big you can't even see the bulge. It's everywhere. It's pervasive, but it will go away. We know that. There's nothing in the history of markets that says when things get that crazy that they then stay crazy forever. Right. Never happens because
forever's
too long.
Well, so we're humans, so we're ruled by narratives. And the main narrative that you know, the Wall Street Journal, the Oval Office, the CNBC, the whole machinery has been trying to run this one narrative, which is, hey, look, you know, the economy's doing great. It's really recovered. You know, we've got nice auto sales again. And so that's one narrative. And then there's another narrative, which is becoming increasingly, you know, obvious, which is that Well, we have this extraordinary wealth gap that's really just courtesy of the central bank printing money and preferentially shoving it into the financial sphere, which drives up financial assets. And so the owners of financial assets preferentially become rich. It's not a mysterious process, except for Janet Yellen, who came out and lectured us all and said, oh, are you experiencing a wealth gap? Well, you need to be a better entrepreneur. You should probably spend more on your kids. And next time you should have wealthy parents. Thank you, Janet, for that little discourse of blame the victim. Love it. Where did you learn that? You know, it's just fantastic, right? But for 99% of the population in the United States, I think elsewhere as well, what I see is that the pie is no longer expanding like it used to. But the people who have access to the pie first, the 1% or 0.1%, they don't know anything other than to keep taking more and more and more. So when the pie's not expanding and you have a small slice that's grabbing more and more and more of it, there's just less and less and less for everybody else. Wander over to statistics and you find things like food stamp usage and average hours worked and part-time jobs versus full-time jobs. All those statistics make sense in a narrative that says the economy isn't growing. It just isn't. And what parts are there are being increasingly taken by this smaller and smaller cadre of people. And that's a theme that I think is starting to emerge here at the end of 2014.
Well, it produces an angry bunch of characters. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, you know, people like to say, well, yeah, this is there's valuation issues here, but it's not like the dot-com era. There actually is a fundamental difference that people are missing here, and that is, I remember talking to my dad about this, where I said, you know, all these crazy companies that are being overbid, when this mess is over, and it hadn't started yet, but we were convinced it would be over at some point, we will at least have a bunch of new technologies to show for the pain and suffering of getting overvalued and malinvestment. So we built out vast fiber optic lines we didn't need immediately, and we overpaid and stuff. But at least we now have fiber optic lines. The current wealth disparity, the one that exists, it's not about the Michael Dells and the Bill Gates and the various tech guys and biotech guys who are changing the world. It is pure the rentier class, the pure moving of money class. Even the tech guys, I don't think are getting any richer. I don't think they're, you know, you say, oh yeah, what about Twitter, right? Somehow Twitter just doesn't feel like a smokestack industry to me. Mm-hmm. I love it, but I don't think that it's so great. It should be a niche. It shouldn't be the source of growth of industry. It doesn't put more food on tables. It doesn't do any of that. And so and that wealth disparity is now so grand that we're in a gilded age now, I think, where you've got these, you know, let them eat cake crowd. And I think that's where that's ultimately there's going to be social unrest. And boy, I spent a lot of time on Ferguson and Bundy Ranch and stuff like that too. I think that Ferguson and Bundy Ranch are foreshadowing of major social upheavals going forward. By the way, I give credit to the Occupy Wall Street crowd. I think Ferguson stems from Occupy Wall Street, and that the Occupy Wall Street guys were the first to figure out how to use social media to try to disrupt society enough to get their attention. Mm-hmm. And so I think now you've got a situation where now imagine how many times over the following years some person's going to get abused by the police, right? Unimaginable number of times, right? That's another theme. But now you've got this mechanism where some kid gets whacked by the police, and this has been happening steadily. But now all of a sudden you got 1,000 grumpy people. They can go shut down the George Washington Bridge. They can go shut down infrastructure. They now can feel the power. These guys say, we've got sharp pitchforks now. And it's not going to go away. We're going to get protests that are stupid. I'm not sure which ones are smart, which ones are dumb. But we're going to get them relentlessly. Because when someone's unempowered and then you give them this power, it's intoxicating too. So, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying it's going to happen, I think.
Yeah, this is a general theme of the social mood darkens. We've seen these anti-austerity riots in Brussels. We've seen, the mass protests in Hong Kong, which were, for a greater, more representative form of democracy. We've seen the protests in Ferguson against unrestrained police violence and lack of accountability. All of those actually fit under a theme for me, which is, again, back to this idea that the pie just isn't growing fast enough for both the 1% to take everything they feel they're entitled to and have enough for everybody else to feel like they've got a piece. all of these are just representations of feeling like there's some inequity in the system, whether it's social inequity, justice inequity, or economic inequity. That's the theme. It makes sense. And so I think you're right. I think as the people start to feel it becomes okay to talk about that inequity, then you get sort of the dam bursts, right? People come roaring out and going, hey, yeah, I have been a little aggrieved about this. I can talk about that now. And I don't know if the protests are useful or helpful or not, but I agree that Occupy Wall Street, you know, they very quietly had to put up with a whole lot of police abuse and Asian provocateurs and having their faces scanned and their cell phones swept electronically and had records made of them. And they had to go through all of that, right? Mostly under the radar. It took a while for the press to catch on and go, hey, that's kind of goofy stuff you got going on there.
Yeah. So I spend a lot of time channeling Matt Taibbi and Rodney Balko's books that they wrote on Taibbi on sort of how the lower class is treated by the police, and Balko talking about the militarization of police. By the way, the Balko book, the militarization, what's it called? Anyway, Rodney Balko, look at that. Something about the militarization of the cops is such a disturbing book because he tells the story of the increase in the military flavor at the police, and it just doesn't feel like hyperbole. It feels like he's being factual and controlled, and it's terrifying. And a guy who I think needs a hat tip, and maybe you should have him on as an interview, is a guy named Michael Krieger, he used to blog about economics. He's just gone totally social, totally civil liberties. I think it's like he's being drawn by the tractor beam here to do it. And he's been out there just screaming. And fortunately, Zero Hedge picks up on him and posts his stuff, and so it gets some legs. But I'd like to throw a big heads up to read Michael Krieger's Liberty Blitz, because he's out there fighting this fight, best I know out there doing this. So,
yep. No, I've read his stuff. It's very good, and because it's almost like there's an outrage du jour. You know, every day there's something crazy, you know, or whether it was Citibank sneaking in a provision into the Cromnibus spending bill to put American taxpayers on the hook for whatever derivative bets the banks can scheme up. You know, it's just crazy that, you know, every day there's a little insult like that. And it's almost too fast to keep up with at this point. And so there's a little, I have a sense of just sitting back watching this and going, all right, there's very little positive to sort of cling to here politically in my own country that I can believe in. So probably just best to watch this. And so let me sneak back to this idea of the narrative. So one of the narratives is, you know, with equity prices being crammed to all-time new highs, I think we had 54 separate incidents of hitting new highs in the year 2014, which, by the way, I think 1929 was the last year that we had so many new highs in a single year. And that should have really been very, very helpful to anybody with a portfolio. One of the mysteries to me, Dave, is the state and municipal pension systems. Every time I crack open the covers and look into those, I'm expecting to see them saying, "Oh, we're very healthy now. We're back to fully funded," or something, and that's just not the case. What's the explanation for that?
I actually think that's logical, because what happens is after they crushed their portfolios in 2009, I think a reasonable individual would say, "You got to go back to acting like a pension fund. You got to go back to acting conservative and a proper fiduciary person, and quit doing this crazy derivatives garbage you're doing." And so the problem is they end up doing it at the bottom. But I think to say, oh, you just lost all our money, now you have to speculate some more, is less rational. So the idea that they sell at the bottom, that's not foolishness. That's almost had to happen, I think, because someone had to step in and say, stop being crazy. So then no one saw the Fed coming at the level that they showed up, right? You and I remember when they bailed out, when they dumped $30 billion, what was it, Bear Stearns? It took my breath away. $30 billion? Are you kidding? You can find $30 billion under the cushions now. That's such a tiny quantity of money compared to what they ended up doing. I don't think anyone would have believed they'd do that. And so to say that a person was stupid or irrational for not getting on this train, that doesn't make sense to me. There are people who got on. We'll see if 5 years from now they're still singing about it. because at some point I think they're going to get crushed. Hussman points out a truism, which is a duh moment, but he points out, he says, look, you think you can get out of there, that's fine. Someone will own these assets by definition all the way back down. So maybe you won't be the one holding them, but someone will. And that multi-trillion dollar extravaganza to the downside is going to crush people again. I think people are out of money. I think they don't have the resources to jump back on. And then you and I, we watched this bull market go, and it was robotically driven, right? Mm-hmm. This thing just marched up. You could put a ruler to it. It is as though there was an algorithm that said, okay, don't let it go below X, make sure it goes up to Y. It is as though it was formulaically programmed into the markets. And, you know, the Federal Reserve governors essentially said that in many, many different speeches. They essentially said, we're focusing on asset prices. They will help bail us out of this mess. So things are working.
Well, it's very interesting, and in that I noted that you had a couple interesting statistics on that whole pension thing, where you know the message, if I could get one out to people, which by the way, the pension benefit guarantee corps is just now struggling, and Congress is weighing this idea of saying, maybe we should just all those people whose pensions were guaranteed, maybe we should force them to take less money. That's how they're gonna shore up. I love that Congress come out. You know, we have to shore up this fund by making these people not receive what they were promised to receive, right? And it is a tragedy, you know, because a lot of cases what happened was that the companies that end up in receivership at the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corps were raided by LBO buyout firms and other places where, you know, they just basically raided everything and then tossed the pension over to the public side. Now the public's saying, I can't afford it. But you had some interesting stats in there, and you noted that just the Chicago Firemen's Pension Fund, just the firemen, we're only talking firemen, is $50,000 of liability per Chicago household. And you note that it's probably higher for households that are actually net payers of taxes. The message that needs to get across there is that won't be paid, firemen from Chicago. It can't be, not at that level.
Yeah, the only way you get out of those at a local level is if someone bails them out at a national level. And that just will exacerbate the national situation. So. But I could imagine that, right? You could imagine some omnibus bill that has the Chicago pension bailout jammed in on December 24th at 30 p.m., right? I can't say for sure any one item will necessarily be a fatality because these things happen. But I don't know. You can't do it for everything. But this year was very tame for the munis, the municipalities and states. Again, sort of on a monetary respirator, survived this year, and so I didn't write too much about them because we're still waiting, mm-hmm. And so why write about something that's just treading water? But at some point that will become a hot topic. Last year, interestingly enough, I wrote very little about Asia and said Asia looks like a continent waiting for something to happen. Boy, that was about as prophetic a statement as I can make. That was really spectacular, actually. So, you know, the different years have different themes. This year seemed to be, here's the interesting thing about this year's theme is that it was, since it was so geopolitical, right, there were market movements, but it seemed geopolitical. What made it a little challenging to write about this year is because that's stuff the mainstream press does a better job at. And so some years when I'm writing, I'm talking about stuff in which I say, you know, mainstream press is AWOL. They're not talking about this at all. This year, the problems, I don't think the mainstream press gets it right necessarily, but at least they were on it. They were on Ferguson. They were on Russia. They were on these topics. And they were on Ebola. And so in some sense, this year was a little bit more of rehashing what actually happened, and a little bit less about saying you idiots didn't get it right. There's still plenty of folly out there that got missed, but a little less than usual.
All right. Well, let's turn now to one of my favorite topics, which is this idea of market manipulation, and this is, the conversation goes a little off the rails sometimes because I'll have people accuse me of being conspiracy theorists as if that's to shut everything down. But let's, 2014 was an important year for learning about all sorts of market manipulations. Of course, we have the overt ones that they tell us about. The Fed is going to manipulate the price of money. It's going to give us a zero interest rate policy. These are all things that the Fed does quite openly. Less openly, we discovered about, what did we discover this year? We discovered that LIBOR, the LIBOR rate, is London interbank offer rate, that which is the main rate which tens of trillions of dollars of derivatives and loans are actually measured against and set against, that that itself was manipulated. And by the way, this took real conspiracies, right? Because the way they get the LIBOR is they take eight banks, they all submit a rate, and then they take the average from the middle four. So the only way you can move that rate is if the middle four are all moving that rate together. So that's a conspiracy, right? We found out about that. It's probably one of the biggest things you could imagine given the impact it has. And they were doing it for years and years and years. The United States basically punted on any sort of action against those people. In Europe, they were going to, actually, I think there'll be a few criminal actions in there. But so we had LIBOR. We had foreign currency manipulation. We had rigging in the London fix in the gold market. You name it. So market manipulations happen a lot. But I'll tell you what, Dave, I think I see market manipulation almost every single day in the tape. And by manipulation, I mean when some entities come in and dump thousands and thousands and thousands of whatever they're doing, shares, options, contracts within a few milliseconds in a way to move price. And they'll do it both directions, either up or down. But when I see coordinated efforts to destroy either the bid stack or the ask stack, I say that's manipulation. Somebody was trading with an intention of moving the price to make money. I see it every day.
Yeah, First, on the question of conspiracy theory, I talk about that every year. This year, I get pretty militant. And you know, I say, you call me a conspiracy theorist. You were simply trying to shut down a reasonable discussion amongst people who are trying to figure out, they're taking a group of characters who are known to be pathological liars, and they're accusing them of lying, right? This is not that odd. What we're trying to do is figure out where and how. And the term conspiracy theorist is designed to stop that discussion because it's like calling you a pedophile or something, right? And mm-hmm. and I get mad at that. And so I say to people, you know, go ahead and call me a conspiracy theorist, but don't be surprised if I smack you in the face. I mean, it just irritates me to no end on that topic. So, yes, I'm a conspiracy theorist. I think men and women of wealth and power conspire. And I think part of our job is to figure out where they're doing it. Part of our job as a society is to get them and hang them from the nearest tree. And that's the big failure. That's where Holder completely blew it. Obama completely blew it. So it is a risk-free trade to conspire to rig the markets. And sometimes it might be those guys, but let's say it's just big money gaming the system, you know, sort of Jesse Livermore kind of gaming, but with huge money. There is no consequence to that, even if it's not a sovereign state trying to move the markets to achieve some political goal, which I do think they do. But also the gamers, the guys who can just get stinking rich off the market, say, well, geez, that's fantastic. We can get in this game too. We can do it too. We can sell, you know, 3 billion ounce equivalents or $3 billion worth of gold at 3 o'clock in the morning and drive the price down. And I don't exactly know how they do it, but they know how to then scoop up the pieces, cover their shorts, and do it again the next morning. I don't know how they do it, but it appears to be done, yes. And again, no one will ever go to jail unless you happen to be some small time patsy and they throw you under the bus. But they're not going to get the big guys for doing this. I'd love to see some discovery in court.
Oh my God, it would be great to actually have a real investigation where we could look at real data and see what's happening. To me, all we'd have to do is take one of those mysterious 3 a.m. dumps and open the tape up and say, who was it? Let's see, was this really 4,000 separate market participants all deciding that was the moment? Or is there one entity? And if that one entity was involved, can we see the rest of the trades that entity was engaged in? Because they probably did something like were short the corresponding equities, had sold, had bought some puts and then went into the futures market and did their business and made so much money on the other parts of those trades that whatever they lost in having to cover their shorts in this side more than made up for it. That's not what trading is supposed to be about, but I see it happening all the time.
It's the Belgians.
That's
for those who don't get that joke. The Belgians supposedly spent 40% of their GDP buying up treasuries. That was comical. And by the way, Belgium itself is a complete basket case. So 40% of their GDP doesn't buy up squat. They don't have the money. They've got they've got their own problems. So clearly someone was using Belgium to do it. Yeah, it happens all the time. And you know, you can rig the markets temporarily, but they will eventually regress to, and eventually, you know, for those mathematically not very gifted, through the mean, mandatorily through the mean, because if you don't go through it, you don't maintain the mean. And so when we finally do regress to and through the mean, it's just going to be a bloodbath because we're so far from equilibrium. And in chemistry, when you're far from equilibrium, you blow up your lab. That's when you get explosions and things like that. And, you know, that's what a forest fire is far from equilibrium. And you get this cathartic, you know, purging event because you become very shock sensitive. And so we'll get there. I don't know if we'll do a 20-year rot or a 10-minute bloodbath. Who knows? But there will be a purge, and it will happen. And people will say, "I can't believe we did this again."
It'll be the third time in 15 years that, you know, we've fallen under the spell of the Fed's serial bubble blowing act, and it didn't work out great the first two times. But this time is I'm very worried about it, and I'll tell you why. It's because of this bond cauldron that you've described, and everything is priced to perfection. So there's really nowhere to hide out. You know, if you had a housing bubble, right, and that starts to blow up, maybe you can go and hide out for a little while over in treasuries, or there's a place to go. Or if you don't like the United States, maybe you can go to Japan. Dave, I can't find any safe asset classes at this point. I can't find any safe regions at this point, because it seems to me like everybody's being insane. But this is a trader that I studied under for a long time. He used to say bubbles always have a final blow-off phase. You have to have that last good surge to the top, which sort of sucks the last molecules of oxygen out, and then the whole thing just sort of keels over. This bubble is really one for the ages. This is not the subprime crisis, the housing bubble, the tech bubble in 2000. All of that stuff to me, Dave, are just symptoms of a larger credit bubble that we've been carefully building since the 70s, early 80s, which was this whole idea that collectively, but particularly at the sovereign level, we could perpetually increase our debts at a faster rate than our incomes. And now you look at global growth on GDP, and nominal growth is nowhere near supportive of the rates of debt growth that we've had over the last 10 years. And yet we continue to grow the debts because the people in charge don't know what else to do. They just don't. They're bereft of ideas. It's like whenever Paul Krugman opens his mouth, I know exactly what he's going to say, you know, because he just doesn't have any other ideas. Him being sort of, I think, a key representative of the Keynesian approach, which is just that we can fix everything by printing more money and getting people into more debt. And if people would just borrow more, we would all have aggregate demand and it would be great. They don't understand where things are today economically, but let alone with respect to energy and other things going on. And it's just, I really feel sometimes like I'm caught in an insane asylum.
So Krugman is almost a caricature of the Keynesians. It's not even fair to the Keynesians to call him a Keynesian. You know, there was this funny QE in Japan too, and it's fantastic. So Japan comes out and says, we're going to boost up the equity markets. They're very overt about that. And it's this idea that somehow if you can print money and, let's say, boost the value of all your houses up and then declare yourself richer. And there was no net gain in productive capacity and no net gain in net worth of any measurable thing. It's just a price tag change. I think our biggest problem, and I have talked about this off and on through the years, is that we compensated people over the years with promises. So instead of saying, look, so what happens is if you pay someone with cash, if it's inflationary, there's this adjustment that occurs. If you compensate someone with promises, what it does is it throws the inflation into a holding pattern. So someone says, oh, I'm now worth a fortune because I have these promises that have been made to me. And they could be municipal pension funds that are underfunded now. They could be assets in your retirement account that are overpriced, and so you don't really own that much value. And these promises are kind of inflation with a lag. And when the boomers start trying to cash out, we're going to either see the inflation show up or we're going to see the deflation show up. I've done a bit of a switch now. I used to be a diehard inflationist, thinking a determined central banker can trigger inflation if they want. And I think one of the things that seems to be coming in this, and, you know, the Austrians got killed this year. Where's the inflation that you promised us, you know, and you guys are just idiots. And, you know, Austrians also do believe in deflation. And the deflation occurs when there's really not enough to go around. And there's not. There's promises for which there's no assets, hard assets to back them. And so we could have a deflation, which will be a form of default. By the way, the other thing we haven't talked about is bail-ins. Last year, Cyprus was the beta test. And, I think I stated explicitly last year that Cyprus was the most important story of the year. Mm-hmm. They confiscated bank accounts recklessly. Now there's all sorts of legislation being put into place all over the world saying that we're not going to make taxpayers bail out the banks. We're going to make the creditors bail out the banks. And everyone says, oh, hooray, hooray. Thank God I'm not going to bail out the banks. Well, what the average person has not a clue is they are a creditor. Their deposit is a creditor. And therefore, what they're saying is we're not going to bail out the banks. We're going to have a bank default. That's what they're saying. And you're going to lose your money. So when you say no place to hide, there is. So my advice to people is spread your assets around a lot of different financial institutions. If you are fortunate enough to be well off, keep your balances below the promise cutoffs and be aware they could change. And change the style of institution. Don't just use TBTFs. Don't just use small local banks. Don't just use brokerages. I have a lot of different types of accounts with money in it, and I'm still nervous. And so that gets us back to this is why the gold fans buy physical gold, because that's the only place you can store money. You can buy a big house that could go down in value, but the house exists at least. I think a big default could take people out in a way, and you'll be told, oh, this is an emergency. There was nothing we could do.
Right.
But don't say you weren't warned. It could very well come.
Well, this is a theme that we've been running at Peak Prosperity all year, is talking about this wealth transfer that's going to happen. First of all, there's already a wealth transfer underway, which is that we live in a regime of financial repression, which has just a few key components. One is to force people into negative real interest rates, right? So you earn 0% on your bank deposits, which are actually not a deposit, but an unsecured loan to an institution, which you just pointed out. So you're getting 0% on your unsecured loan to this institution, and your inflation is obviously higher than zero. So but they just present it like, oh, well, that's just too bad. Inflation is, you know, higher than your interest. I guess you're just losing purchasing power, as if it's a mysterious thing. But it gets transferred. That purchasing power gets transferred. It's an accounting identity. It doesn't just disappear. The only question we have to ask is, who's getting it? Well, that's easy. We can wander over to the statistics and find out who's getting stinking rich today and who's not. And that tells you who's transferring to whom. And then the other part of this program, which is really essential, is capital controls. So we have soft capital controls all over the place with the FATCA Act preventing, go and try and open up. You say, you know, spread your assets around. Trying to open an account now as an American overseas is very difficult,
yeah,
if not impossible in many jurisdictions, because the banks are like, you're not worth it, dude. Forget about it. And then the last piece is to make sure that the price of gold doesn't give people a place that they think they can safely go to. You have to put people in a corral and just force them into your financial repression regime. And that's the thing they've been running. And it's an active program. I call it throw granny under the bus. It's really been stealing from everybody. But the thing that's just really difficult about this for me, Dave, is that it's completely obvious that the people who are benefiting from this, which is the government that can go ahead and overspend, and the banks who have first access to that capital, they're both making out like bandits. And this is a wealth redistribution.
But we all are going to lose in the end. There's not a lot of winners when it finally comes to a head.
Right.
And Hussman had a very clever phrase. Hussman's getting crushed, right? By any measure, Hussman's getting crushed. I think he's dead right, and he's just being eviscerated because the prices say he's wrong, right?
Right.
But he said you can either look like an idiot before the crash or after the crash. And that so right now we're looking like idiots. But I'd rather look like an idiot now than later. And anyone listening to this who's a bull is going to think we're just a couple of idiots.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a guarantee.
Because prices are always right, Dave. You know that, right?
Yeah, I know. Price discovery's also been a theme. I post on Twitter a lot, and the market goes up 100 points and sits there flat all day long, and I'll post a picture of that on Twitter, and I will say I gotta love that price discovery. And every day, almost, I find a plot of something that looks like someone just parked it. Mm-hmm. And there's a square root function. The market dips for the first half hour, then ramps up, and then parks. You know, it's gonna make us suffer. And you gotta white knuckle it. I'm gonna have no trouble not jumping in. You know, if they're waiting for me to get in the market before they throw in the toaster oven, it's not gonna happen. Because the one thing I also know is that, let's say I was a fool for not buying in this market. I now know that I am a fool buying into this market, because it's now every last possible dollar of gain has been squeezed out of prospective gain, right? And so now I can't get in, and I know I can't get in. And so there's nothing that's going to get me to say I better buy.
I'll tell you, there is something that would get me to do it, and that's when the Fed decides that it's had enough of shoveling money into one end of the pig, and it decides to shovel money into the other end, and that would be in the form of, let's say that they conspire or work with the federal government to create a way to get fresh printed Federal Reserve dollars into the hands of people. So this might look like a tax rebate. Like, I might wake up in April 2015 and they might say, oh, guess what? No taxes is here, and we're giving you back last year's taxes. That's when I run. I do not walk. I run, and I spend every dollar I have on something. And it might be stocks. It might be real estate. It might be more gold. It might be Stradivarius violins. It won't matter. I'm just going to buy stuff, because that to me is the final act in this story.
Inflation right out onto the top of the fold of the newspaper then. Yep. Right. So, but I'm not. I don't think I'll buy equities under those conditions. I think I would still stay in some sort of hard asset flavored thing.
Yeah, me too, probably.
Conceivably, could go after maybe something like Walmart, right? There. I could convince myself maybe a little, but to commit, right? You know, and I know that to make serious money in some idea, you have to commit to it. And there, I would just never have the heart to go at that one.
Yep.
Aggressively, you know, and if you think about what it takes to get 10 or 15% of your portfolio committed in one direction, again, if you're broke, it only takes 10 or 15 bucks. But if you've amassed a reasonable wealth over the years, it's a stunning amount of money to get committed in a new direction. You've got to believe almost at a religious level that you're right. And that one would not convince me is the problem.
All right. So here we are, you know, we're winding up 2014. 2015, as you look forward, what are you going to be tracking most closely?
Well, I think the energy story and all its consequences it's unimaginable to me that that's not going to play out through 15. I think, you know, I don't have the link to it anymore, but I read the House of Commons met 14 days before World War I, and the notes from that meeting, the minutes from the meeting, have not a single reference to military risk. So it's immediately clear to me on that sort of metaphor that that if something really, really calamitous kicks into gear, we're not going to get a lot of warning. And that's why pushing Putin around seems so, so stupid to me, because he will lash out and we will get some nasty stuff if you corner Putin. You do not want to corner Putin, I think. And so that could be a big player. At some point when the bond market goes, it'll just be sit back and try to stay out of the splash zone completely if you can. And again, what do I do? I've got a bank account. I've got a bank account with ungodly sums of money. I still haven't moved it. I still haven't diversified enough. And it could get crushed. I'll be better off than the next guy, but not. I won't be happy. I still haven't figured it out completely.
Well, yeah, that is our other macro theme in the wealth transfer, is that first there's this sort of slow grinding transfer that's happening because of the financial repression. But we know that there's this massive imbalance between the putative stated current value of the financial assets and the size of the real economy. And eventually those two things have to come back into focus, and they always do. And we will call that a great wealth transfer. Again, this one will be much more aggressive, much more rapid. But it's basically like those people from the who have their pensions now under the PBGC. They'll wake up one day and they'll say, "Oh, by the way, you have 50% less than you thought. You know, we have to cut your pensions in half. Sorry." And it just happens. And people are like, well, where'd it go? That's what I see as the macro theme, is that there's a big where did it go moment coming. And depending on how you're positioned, there will be relative greater and lesser losers in that story. But first, you have to know what the story is.
Yeah, I'm going to go buy some of that $60 million balloon art and hide in there, I think. Yeah, it's what makes gold bugs gold bugs, I think. It's stupid to be loaded up on something as volatile as gold, but I'm having trouble finding other ideas. And so this year, by the way, I bought gold in '99 through brokerage accounts, CEF, and I bought it steadily and bought physical sort of handful of ounces at a time until around 2004. And then my position just was too big through a combination of appreciation and buying, and I didn't touch it again. I didn't sell any, but I didn't buy anymore, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. Then the rout occurred that caused you and I and others to suffer in serious ways. I am back in the market this year, and I haven't been rewarded yet, but I've been back in the market and only buying physical sovereign coins. And for your readers, I pay cash. I get a receipt and I pay cash. I'll let them fill in the gap as to why. But this whole, there are actually people out there getting their bank accounts confiscated because the feds decide that they're up to no good. And Forbes did a great article that showed these people are not getting their money back. So I'm nervous even about that. Right. So I'm really worried about the confiscation story.
Yeah.
I don't know how to duck it when the jackboots show up. You're not going to be able to hang on to much.
Well, yeah, so that's a whole other topic. Maybe I'll get Michael Krieger on to talk about that, which is civil forfeiture, which is just an absolute complete shredding of every possible thing that I understood about how property rights and laws are supposed to work. It's just a disgusting, disgusting display of just it's stealing. It's just flat out stealing.
Total theft, complete and utter theft at the point of a gun.
Yep. And yeah, call that what you will. So, all right, well, I'm looking for, you know, I am going to be tracking the energy story. To me, that is the not just in terms of price, but it's the amount of energy we've got. Oh, there's such a story coming, and a lot hinges on how long oil stays down. And, you know, in this part of the story, the Fed discovers it can't print oil, you know, and other central banks. So that's really going to be it. But I do think that somewhere in the next year or two, there is this reckoning coming. I do believe that my model is that the collective status quo defending authorities are going to do everything possible to prevent it from coming. They will do everything. And so when it comes, it's going to overwhelm them. So it's going to be a rather sudden, rapid event. I think you're either positioned for it or you're not. Those are your choices, because it'll be very hard to maneuver once it's happening, I think.
And don't be surprised if the event is hidden under the guise of some other geopolitical event. So it's not going to just happen.
Oh, I know, yeah.
There is going to be some event which they say, hey, don't blame us, it was the Russians. Don't blame us, it was the Iranians. Don't blame us, it was someone else. That's why your money's gone. This is a national security problem. This is Save America problem. Your money's gone because you're a patriot, right? It'll be some malarkey like that. That's why, you know, I think the correlation of war and civil unrest and stuff, that's why it occurs, is because war covers up. The end of World War II, I've said this several times, but at the end of World War II, there was rubble everywhere, and there were people sitting on what used to be their houses. But what's also true is most of the debts of Europe got erased, and no one complained because they were trying to figure out where their next meal was. And I'm not saying they fought World War II to erase debts, but it does correlate.
Yes, it happens. So with that, Dave, thank you so much for your time and for writing the excellent year-end review, and we'll do this again.
You bet.